طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we explore issues related to Israeli policies in Jerusalem, including ongoing displacement of Palestinian residents and expansion of Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem. Why Jerusalem continues to serve as a catalyst for Palestinian protest and Israeli violence in response, and how Jerusalem continues to be at the heart of Palestinian and Israeli national aspirations. You will hear portions of a webinar titled, Who's Jerusalem?, featuring Daniel Seidman from Terrestrial Jerusalem, Dana L. Kurd, non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute, and Munir Nuseiba from Al-Quds University. It is co-moderated by Khaled El-Gindi of the Middle East Institute and Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. It begins with Laura Friedman framing the issue.
The first round is going to be sort of a scene setter round, just as a brief introduction. So as the center of national aspirations of both Palestinians and Israelis, as well as a place sacred to Jews, Christians, and Muslims worldwide, Jerusalem has long been seen as the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. However, the reality today is that one side, Israel, has exercised almost total control over the political, demographic, geographic, and physical realities in Jerusalem for many years, including Israeli West Jerusalem and occupied East Jerusalem. So in this session, we're going to look at the range of Israeli policies in Jerusalem, including settlement expansion, displacement of Palestinians in East Jerusalem, and Palestinian responses in the context of these competing claims to Jerusalem. So Munir, I want to start with you. Can you start off by giving us a sense of what daily life is like for the 400,000 or so Palestinians who live as legal residents in Jerusalem? You know, what is their legal and political status vis-a-vis Israel, the PA, and how do their rights and privileges differ from those of Israelis? And then maybe overarching, you know, what are the challenges, the most serious challenges they face as residents of Jerusalem now and over time?
Thank you very much, Lara and Khaled. So when Israel annexed the eastern part of Jerusalem in 1967, it gave a residency status to all Palestinians who lived in East Jerusalem. So despite the fact that they illegally, according to international law, annexation of occupied territory is illegal. So illegally occupied, annexed the eastern part of Jerusalem at the time, they refrained from giving citizenship to the population, but they only gave them a permanent residency status. This status is very different compared to Israeli citizenship. On the one hand, it gives the person who holds this status the right to live in the city, to work, to be a member of the social welfare and medical insurance, to pay taxes into these systems, and also to receive rights and entitlements from these systems. However, one of the most important aspects of this status is that it is easily revocable. Since 1967, Israel has revoked over 14,600 residencies from Palestinians in East Jerusalem based on a number of criteria. It started off by revoking the residencies of everyone who left the country country for 7 years, or who stayed or who got a residency or a citizenship abroad. Later on, it developed additional methods for revoking residencies. It invented a new criterion after the peace process, unfortunately, according to which the residency of a permanent resident would be revoked if their center of life is outside what Israel considers part of its sovereign territory, which includes all of the West Bank, except for East Jerusalem and Gaza Strip. So after the peace process, the Israel started, you know, speeding up the revocation of residences from Palestinians in Jerusalem. And this is an important part of its demographic control, the way of minimizing the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem. At the same time, also in 2016, Israel added a new method according to a new law. They added a new method for residency revocation called breach of allegiance to the state of Israel. So if a permanent resident is accused of breaching allegiance to the state of Israel, they are also liable to having their residency revoked. Those who have their residency revoked, regardless of whether they are actually living in Jerusalem or outside Jerusalem, they lose the right to live in Jerusalem. But in addition to the residency revocation, we have the restrictions on child registration and family unification. So we have this status, residency, is not a citizenship. It doesn't pass automatically to children. So there is a very complicated bureaucracy according to which and many conditions that you have to follow in order to register your children as residents. And this has left many children and also adults who have not been registered in the population registry, in the Israeli population registry. Many who are not stateless, because all of us are stateless. We don't have a citizenship. You asked also about status in the PLO and other places. So we have no citizenship at all. Most of the Palestinians in Jerusalem have no citizenship at all. So we are, most of us are stateless. But there are people in Jerusalem who I call statusless. They have no status whatsoever. They cannot live anywhere on this planet legally. Many of them. One of the things that we do in my work is that I head a center that belongs to Al-Quds University that provides legal aid to Palestinians. We represent families with children and adults who have no legal status at all, who live in Jerusalem, according to the Israeli legal system, illegally, only because their parents at some point did not manage to give them a legal status because of all of the Israeli bureaucracy and discriminatory laws that are restricting passing legal status to these children. But also family unification. So Palestinians in East Jerusalem who want to get married to fellow Palestinians from the rest of the West Bank or from Gaza Strip, according to the Israeli law, cannot actually pass their status to their spouses. So their spouses who are living in Jerusalem with them can never become permanent residents. If the spouses are from the West Bank, they cannot even apply for family unification, and they have to live either separately or to live abroad together, which will risk, obviously, the residency status of the spouse from Jerusalem. But if they are from Gaza Strip, they can get temporary residency statuses, not residency, permits to stay in Israel, in the way that the Israeli law organized. So back to your first question, and maybe I should not make my answer much longer than that. You asked, how do Palestinians live in Jerusalem? And the way I have my personal experience as a Palestinian in Jerusalem, but also what I witness as a legal aid provider, I see that Palestinians are all the time running between Israeli governmental institutions in order to only survive and be able to live in their own city, in order to get the most basic rights, like living in your house, like medical aid, the things that should be taken for granted, that are taken for granted everywhere else around the world. Palestinians are all the time spending their time, their money, their energy, and their nerves in order to be able to survive. And I've only described their civil status, and there are many other that I'm sure we will discuss in other questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Munir. If I could, I want to turn to you, Danny, as an Israeli and as a lawyer and as someone who's focused on Jerusalem for many, many years. Help sort of fill out the picture for us a little bit more. We heard a little bit about the kinds of policies Israel uses with regard to the Palestinian community in Jerusalem. What is the overarching vision that Israel has in implementing these kinds of policies? Most of us are familiar with Israel's settlement project and Israeli settlements and the problems that they posed. But what are some of the other tools that Israel uses to achieve its overarching vision?
To begin to answer that question, I would suggest reading a piece of literature called The Trump Plan. and treat it as a document that discloses intent, because in our years working together, Lara, we have seen the Trump plan folding out in Netanyahu's policies for many years. Trump put them into words. And if I can very briefly articulate what that entails, I would say it is the fragmentation of Palestinian East Jerusalem and fragmentation of its connection to the Palestinian hinterland and the West Bank to the north and south. It is a fragmentation that's geographical, it is social, and it's political. Secondly, we have an attempt to denationalize the Palestinians, to turn them from a national collective with equal equities and parities in Jerusalem into a tolerated minority. One of my Palestinian calls this the Jaffaization of Jerusalem, and I mean no aspersion to Palestinian citizens of Israel who live in Jaffa, but somehow, excuse my bluntness, domesticated Palestinians will know their place. And that means crushing any possible political activity, however moderate or innocent it might be. And finally, we have the marginalization of Muslim and Christian equities in the city. And we have been witnessing for many years the religious radicalization that is taking place in and around the old city, something that we will address later. I want to focus on two areas in which this is playing out very specifically, because Trump and Netanyahu may be gone, but their spirit lingers for reasons we will probably discuss later. I would say two things. Number one, we have a continuance of the classic settlement enterprise of construction of new Israeli neighborhoods beyond the Green Line, illegally, contrary to international law, but it's not happening everywhere. It's happening in a very specific place, and that is on the southern flank of Jerusalem, across the entire southern flank from Har Gilow, the settlement in the west, to the southeast corner in Har Choma, is being filled with settlements of the expansion of Har Gilow, Achuzat Gilow, Givat Matos. We now have a new settlement, brand new, under this current government. And this is a linear development which has a qualitative impact, and the qualitative impact is severing East Jerusalem from its environs in the West Bank. That is not about to happen. That is happening now. Secondly, we've been monitoring settlement enclaves, small areas that are located in the old city and around the old city. They're enclaves because they were isolated and discontinuous with Israel. Today, we are witnessing a change that is not linear. It is a quantum change. And that is the expansion of these settlements by means of continued an expansion of the settlements themselves, major governmental projects. And here we link to, for the first time since June of 1967 with the Mughrabi border, large-scale displacement of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. Not everywhere, but in the areas that are targeted by the settlers. And that means hundreds of families in risk of displacement in Sheikh Jarrah, hundreds of families in risk of displacement in Silwan, and you can add the uptick in demolitions in these areas. What we're seeing is the encirclement of the old city with settlements and a settler-related enterprises, which will literally embrace the old city. Now, that is being done with Sheikh Jarrah through Mount Scopus in the north, Silwan, Ras El Amud, Mount of Olives to the south. There is a large gap in the middle, and the churches get in the way. Most of the area between the northern Pincer movement and the southern Pincer movement are churches. These are the holiest sites in Christendom. And so we will be, what we're seeing unfolding, and you will be hearing more of this, is placing the holiest sites in Christianity in or adjacent to a national park, which will be under the sway of the settlers. This is a major change, something that no Israeli government has done in the past. This will, A, undermine the stability of the city. This will not go unnoticed. It is not an accident that violence erupted when we started tinkering with the two most sensitive issues in this conflict, displacement and holy sites and the centrality of Jerusalem. And when we tinkered with them, we got the eruption of violence last May. It will make any future political agreement much more difficult, regardless of one's model. There is no model which gives Israel exclusive hegemony over Jerusalem with tolerated minorities, whether they're Palestinian, Muslim, or Christian. And finally, this is a threat. It's a crime against Jerusalem. This threatens, regardless, put politics aside. I know that's not possible. This undermines the historic religious and cultural integrity of Jerusalem. This will not go unnoticed. It has not been adequately articulated yet. It will be, and this needs to be engaged sooner rather than later and rather robustly. This is something that is that folks in whom are making decisions are becoming aware of. These are the two changes that are taking place today: sealing Jerusalem from Bethlehem and the encirclement of the Old City.
Thanks, Denny. And you gave me a great lead-in for my question for Dana, which Denny talked about the marginalization of Palestinian political activity in Jerusalem. And we've seen reports of arrests when there are meetings of almost any kind, of almost any grouping in Jerusalem claiming it's illegal activity. So I want to ask you about the political side of this. So last year, the long-delayed Palestinian elections were canceled. And they were canceled, ostensibly, at least in part, over Israel's refusal to allow Palestinians in East Jerusalem to vote. In the last elections, there was a mechanism by which they could vote. Talk about, if you will, what role Jerusalem and Jerusalemites play in Palestinian politics, and what, if anything, the Palestinian leadership, which is not present in Jerusalem technically, is doing to counter the negative trends that Munir and Denny talked about.
Yeah, thank you for the important question. So it's true, everything that was already mentioned by the other speakers, there are, you know, great impediments to Palestinian organizing in Jerusalem and Palestinian connection to, you know, other communities in historic Palestine, to the you know, the politics of the Palestinian Authority. Whether it's sheer repression, like you said, shutting down meetings or shutting down institutions, even cultural institutions, all of those things that happen in Jerusalem regularly at the hands of the Israeli state, but socially as well. However, I would say that despite this marginalization, that's very, you know, purposive and targeted, Palestinians in Jerusalem have been able to mobilize uniquely. because of that marginalization almost. So they are not represented by the Israeli government. They're not Palestinian citizens of Israel. It's a different kind of relationship to the Israeli political authority. On top of that, they, you know, the Palestinian Authority is not allowed to function in Jerusalem, and their historic institutions that exist in Jerusalem have been shut down, have been limited. So in some ways, obviously that's a huge impediment to their ability to organize and to resist the status quo, but also it leaves them unencumbered by the considerations and constraints of other Palestinian communities within the Green Line and in the territories. And so they can, what we've seen is that they can refocus their resistance on the Israeli state itself in a way that maybe other communities find it more difficult to accomplish. So they have been able to protest directly in inspiring ways, in creative ways, in large numbers. And every time we have one of these waves of protest, whether it's in 2014 with Mohammed Abu Khader's murder, or 2017 with the Al-Aqsa restrictions, the iterative waves of protests that we see coming out of Jerusalem, their political mobilization helps refocus the crux of this conflict, that this is a conflict as a result of settler colonialism, as a result of the nature of the Israeli state. And it's not a squabble over lines in the West Bank or how many permits are allotted to Gaza or any of these kinds of policy outcomes necessarily that people might focus on. But it's a problem of the state itself. And we see that this is their impact when we look at how they spark protests across the entirety of Israel-Palestine. In the occupied territories, since 2007, I have research that shows that, you know, the most sustained protests have been at the margins, that the Palestinian urban centers have been somewhat demobilized. But Jerusalem is this unique mobilizer. So during the events of May of last year, oh my gosh, we're already, I guess, last year. It's been a year. So during the events of the Unity Intifada, it was called the Unity Intifada, Palestinians in Jerusalem, they built on those previous waves of protests, and the know-how and the skill set that they were able to build each time to once again mobilize effectively in Jerusalem around certain issues that were, you know, whether it's, I mean, we could talk about this further, but like whether it's the repression that in the Old City or the expulsions in different neighborhoods. But then they also coordinated with activists in other parts of Palestine. And again, we can talk about, you know, in more detail what that looked like. But the PA has been quite absent in all of this. They even intervened to stop some of the protests that happened in the West Bank that emerged in response to the events in Jerusalem. And they haven't really stepped in to service the Palestinian population there, as far as I'm aware, for like beyond, you know, maybe talking points or slogans when it comes to things like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and these kinds of expulsions that, or just the general, you know, living conditions of Palestinians in Jerusalem, they haven't really advocated for them effectively.
Thanks, Dana. So I want to stay with you for a moment and ask you to do two things, if you could. If you could just first kind of take us a step back and tell us a little bit about the role that Jerusalem plays in the Palestinian politics, in Palestinian political consciousness. How central is it? For example, you know, we hear a number of centrist Israelis who talk about their support for a two-state solution, but one that would not include dividing Jerusalem or allowing for a Palestinian capital in Jerusalem. How feasible are, and of course the Trump plan was similar in that sense, how feasible are those kinds of proposals? Is Jerusalem really all that central to a future political settlement and to Palestinians in general? And then I want to ask you if you could zoom back in on the situation of Palestinian Jerusalemites in particular in light of the recent report by Amnesty, which describes the situation on both sides of the 1967 lines as one of apartheid. Does that label apply in your view in East Jerusalem in particular, and how is it different from the experiences of Palestinians in other parts of the occupied territories?
Always the same thing. You'll have to remind me if I forget to answer a part of this. So first, like the role that Jerusalem plays in Palestinian politics, how central is it? The feasibility of removing Jerusalem out of the equation. Essentially, that's the first kind of set of questions. So, I mean, I don't think it's feasible at all. I don't think Palestinians would accept any kind of political negotiation that doesn't include Jerusalem, that isn't going to address the fact that 400,000 Palestinians live in Jerusalem, and that it does play this very central role in animating politics, in animating mobilization, just both historically, culturally, and religiously. You know, Jerusalem has been the crux of both political organizing prior to the Oslo Accords, and for some time after. But, you know, there's a religious resonance there. Part of the success of the mobilizations this past summer, where we saw busloads of Palestinians from communities within the Green Line coming to Jerusalem to pray and protest, is because of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because of the religious significance animated by, you know, the Islamic movement. And while Israel has been, you know, quite successful in, as has already been mentioned, repressing Jerusalem in terms of closing down cultural institutions, you know, so it makes it difficult for the Palestinians in Jerusalem to play the same role they once did in politics. But as I said, there are these opportunities as well because of this marginalization. So I think people are inspired by the movements that emerge from Jerusalem in spite of the odds. And then, you know, the history of Jerusalem as a focal point for Palestinian politics is remembered as well. So all of that kind of combined would make it very, you know, very ludicrous to suggest kind of any of the solutions that have been floated, whether it's making parts of East Jerusalem the capital of Palestine, we saw under the Trump administration that was floated, or just not discussing it at all. So there is, you know, I don't know, there's an ethos around Jerusalem that's hard to replicate elsewhere, and that does animate Palestinians in a unique way. The second part of your question, I'm already forgetting.
Well, if you could just briefly discuss the Palestinian, the status of Palestinian Jerusalemites in the context
of the amnesty.
Of the apartheid label.
Yeah, so, I mean, different Palestinian communities across the Green Line all face discrimination as a result of their identity, but it doesn't have to be the exact same discrimination to merit an apartheid label. So there are like gradations, obviously. Palestinians in Jerusalem may have more freedom of movement, but as Munir has already, you know, addressed, you know, very well, they have severe limitations on their ability to remain in Jerusalem, on their political representation. You know, they don't vote in anything. They're not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to do anything like that. They're not serviced. They pay taxes. They get very little services. So I think that there is, you know, a lot of truth to the apartheid label. I know that there are criticisms that it, again, does not capture enough the settler colonial nature of the Israeli state. I think the Amnesty report went farther than previous reports have done in pointing out that connection. So to me, it doesn't seem like it's mutually exclusive. And we can use the apartheid label if, you know, to advocate in a certain direction. And it's I don't know, it seems like a very reasonable thing a very reasonable concept to use in this case.
Munir, I want to come back to you. Both you and Danny talked about the status of Palestinians in Jerusalem. You talked about Palestinians fighting really just to exist sort of day to day. And I want to pick up on that and talk about sort of the threats. And you talked about, you know, the people not being, you know, getting IDs and whatever. There's a whole range of threats, obviously. But the threat that is most often in the news these days is the threats related to demolitions and expulsion, which is, you know, how that relates to people actually having their very presence in the city, their ability to stay in their homes and having that challenged. And particularly we're looking at Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. So can you talk about the situation in these two areas and talk about to what extent the threats in these areas are examples of the kinds of threats Palestinians face more broadly, even if these two areas are special because of geography and history and all that?
As Danny mentioned earlier, Israel has, since it occupied the city, expropriated, confiscated a lot of land from Palestinians in Jerusalem. Over 30% of land of East Jerusalem was confiscated for building settlements. But then there were areas that were either unplanned or not planned for residents, made like green areas and all of that. And only 13% of the land of East Jerusalem was designated for construction, for constructing houses in East Jerusalem. This is the zoning policy, the Israeli zoning policy. And most of this area was already built. So basically what this actually means is that the Israeli authorities, since the occupation of East Jerusalem, have not allowed Palestinians to live legally, to build legally. It is estimated that between half, between one third to half of the buildings in East Jerusalem are built without a permit, because it's very difficult, in many cases impossible, to get a permit to build if you are Palestinian. This is, of course, while at the same time Israel is building huge neighborhoods, settlements that are Jewish-only settlements. But this is the Palestinian experience, is that it's very difficult to build and to expand. And because of this, Israel demolishes homes of Palestinians. This is another thing that the center where I work actually works. We represent families with home demolition orders because they did not manage to get a permit to build their home. So they have a piece of land and the family is expanding. So they built and then they got a demolition order. And in most, in the best case scenario, what we call a success is postponing the demolition. And I'm ashamed to say that. It's not a success. The success would be for people to be able to live in their homes with dignity. But when we manage to postpone it, because this is the best we can get, we consider this a success of our legal representation. And this is the same for all the other centers and lawyers who are working in the area of East Jerusalem. Now, zooming into Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, both of these neighborhoods, one of them is immediately in the north, you know, exactly in the north of the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah. And Silwan is exactly at the south of the walls of the Sheikh of the old city. And what we are witnessing now, what started, you know, a while ago, but what we're witnessing now in a much quicker way, is a policy of Judaization of these two neighborhoods. Israel's plan at the beginning of the occupation was to Judaize, build settlements and Judaize areas in the surrounding of Jerusalem, to start new settlements. And they built quite, you know, a belt of Israeli settlements around the city. Now, they have this policy of settling in the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods. And, you know, the most important neighborhoods are Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan, but also the old city of Jerusalem, actually, where we see a lot of evictions, a lot of demolitions. So people living in these neighborhoods are always... so, for example, I live myself in Sheikh Jarrah, and I'm close to, and I follow and I visit frequently families in Sheikh Jarrah who are at the risk of this of displacement, because a settler organization claims that the land on which they live was owned by Jewish owners before 1948. And therefore they are they have been in a court battle in Israel, the Israeli court battle, for, you know, decades now, making, you know, targeting the eviction of these populations. Of course, the law that is being used for this for these evictions is an Israeli law. Is the Israeli law, which is, of course, illegal in international law for the occupying power to apply its own law in an occupied territory. And the courts that are taking the decisions in these cases are Israeli courts. And this is also illegal in international law. However, what we see continuously are people who are defending themselves and defending their presence in their homes in Israeli courts, losing cases and eventually being evicted gradually. At the same time, we see that the Israeli law is quite discriminatory. It allows Jews to claim their properties in East Jerusalem, but it doesn't allow Palestinians. So until now, none of us have spoken about West Jerusalem, right? And about the rest of the area that became Israel in 1948. There 80% of Palestinians were forcibly displaced from these areas, and all of West Jerusalem has been completely de-Palestinized, you know, like all the Palestinians who lived there were totally displaced. There are no Palestinians living in West Jerusalem anymore, right, since 1948. And despite that, Palestinians cannot claim, according to the Israeli law, cannot claim and force to get their own properties in the western part of Jerusalem. So the way the Israeli law plays is if you're Jewish, you can make any claim anywhere. But if you're Palestinian, you cannot do that. And this leads me actually to also comment on your apartheid question, if you may, you know, if you allow me. I think that the use of the apartheid framework by not only, you know, by Amnesty, the latest report, but also by other organizations like B'Tselem, like Yesh Din, like Human Rights Watch, and Al-Haq, and Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, and others actually, is very important. I think it makes the problem clearer. It's not only an issue that is related to conflict, armies, wars, and all of that. It is a regime that continuously puts Palestinians in an inferior position. And continuously, and this is what apartheid is about, basically. It's about a regime that works on creating domination of one racial group over another racial group. And the crime of apartheid is conducting inhumane acts in order to maintain this regime and to keep it. And this is what we're witnessing. So the use of this framework is quite significant because it reminds us always that negotiations and peace is not only about, you know, drawing a line here and there, but is also about human rights and about ending the regime that actually conducts all of these inhumane acts and replacing it with a regime that treats people equally. You know, equality as a constitutional value, which is recognized in most countries around the world, is not a principle recognized by the state of Israel. It doesn't exist in its two human rights laws that that it enacted in 1992. So this is something that I think should be addressed not only in Jerusalem, but everywhere else.
Thanks, Munir. Danny, I want to come back to you. And if we could maybe dig a little bit deeper on the other side of this coin. We heard a lot about the pressure that is put on Palestinians, the fragmentation of Palestinian society, of limiting the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. On the other side of the coin, of course, is the settlements. As one of the foremost Israeli experts on both settlements and Jerusalem, what role do the settlers and their supporters play, including those who are, of course, in positions of power in the government, as well as in the Jerusalem municipality and other posts? What is the role that settlers play in the displacement of Palestinians? Where do these groups and figures fall within the broader Israeli body politic? What is their relationship to the state? And looking at any patterns of settlement-related activities over the years and through the present day, what are the overarching objectives of the settlers, particularly with regard to Jerusalem?
It's a great question, and one we have been asking ourselves, especially since the formation of a new government. Now, we've been monitoring settlements for many years, and Lara and I can tell you how far back we dealt with E1 and trying to prevent E1. doomsday settlement to the east of Jerusalem, similar one in Atarot. Netanyahu didn't dare carry out E1. He tried a couple of times, but he was stopped. And this government, which is supposed to be a centrist coalition government, has allowed things to happen that Netanyahu didn't dare do. And when you look at the dynamic, it's fascinating. I am convinced, I have, I think, direct knowledge, that when E1 and Atarot, the two doomsday settlements, were put on the agenda, it was done without the knowledge of either the prime minister or the foreign minister or the defense minister, which is quite remarkable. Now, this could not have happened under Netanyahu. I would say that under this government, there is less malice, but much less control. And Netanyahu knew nothing happens in Jerusalem without me. That is no longer the case. What is the case is the following, and this is the dynamic that I've seen, but it's only part of the dynamic. And that dynamic is that official Israel, that Netanyahu and occupation have succeeded in splicing the ideology of the settler organizations in general, and in particular in Jerusalem, into the organizational DNA of Israel. The policeman at Damascus Gate does not need an order in order to beat up a Palestinian kid. He needs an order to stop. What happened with E1 and Atarot was, hey, nobody's minding the store. And the people in the higher planning committee of the West Bank, an organ of the Ministry of Defense, who are all settlers or settler sympathizers, say, let's take advantage of it. We have an uptick in demolitions. Did the prime minister or the mayor of Jerusalem say, hey, let's do demolitions? No. We have a deputy mayor who, even by settler standard, is considered to be extreme and eccentric. He has a symbolic job, but the people in the planning department, the enforcement department, and the legal department in the municipality of Jerusalem are settler and settler sympathizers. So even somebody who is weak can affect an enormous change. In other words, occupation is not what we do, occupation is what we have become, at least until now. Now, this explanation is not entirely adequate, because I have seen a compendium of events coming from the highest levels, which cannot be accidental or coincidental. There is a field marshal inside the Israeli government. I do not believe it's the prime minister, the foreign minister, the defense minister. It doesn't matter. But there is somebody with a strategy, and that strategy is being implemented by the settler regime within official Israel. I would describe the Israeli government not as a government, but as a loose association of feudal fiefdoms run by a manager, like a supermarket manager. You have those with a strategy who are advancing settlement schemes and have the full cooperation of the bureaucracy. You have the Israeli left who, unlike their counterparts on the right, are disturbed by this but will not go to the mattresses and are rather ineffectual. And then you have the prime minister, the defense minister, and they are either clueless, uninformed, or pretend to be so. And they are not willing to challenge yet what is happening. So ironically, the dynamic that was set in play by Trump and Netanyahu has accelerated. Having said that, there is what to work with. I'm in touch with a number of the ministers in the government. There's a learning process. And one of my takeaways, and the takeaways of colleagues who are even in a better position than myself to know, there is the one thing that concerns the senior members of this government most is losing the Democratic Party, which is remarkable. And that gives leverage. And that means that they are attentive to voices in Congress and the administration when engaged that can be put to good effect. But that means calling a spade a spade. I will leave the apartheid discussion. I cannot get into it now. I'm not afraid of it. And there are developments. But What we are describing is that it is impossible to describe Israeli rule without using the term occupation. It's not a value judgment. It is an empirical judgment. And occupation is what informs our actions and the nature of Israeli rule. It is absolutely imperative to make that term commonplace in the United States, in the body politic, in the American Jewish community, and to engage on this. Because we now are in a situation where there are accelerated developments in Jerusalem, much of them without malice, but they're happening anyway. There is zero political horizon. We have a prime minister who has declared no interest whatsoever in talking, zero political horizon, hopelessness, the likes of which I have not seen in the years that we need engagement from friends of Israel. And there are ministers in this government who are going to be attentive to that. If not, this is going to continue, and we need to incentivize the prime minister, the defense minister, and the foreign minister to engage on this and stiffen the spines of those who purport to be our allies in the Israeli cabinet.
You have been listening to Who's Jerusalem? A webinar featuring a variety of voices speaking on the struggles taking place in Jerusalem as we speak. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.